Welcome to Independence, the FIEC podcast. My name's Phil Topham, Executive Director of the FIEC, and it's time for In the News, our regular look at the news stories that have been going on in our world. And with me, as ever, is our National Director, John Stevens. Hello, John.
Hi, Phil.
And our Head of National Ministries, Adrian Reynolds. Hello.
Come on, the Wanderers.
Yes, indeed.
It's a final this Sunday.
It's a big weekend, yeah. Papa John's. Anyway, we'll... We won't come back to that. We've said far too much about it on this podcast. Brothers, I want us to start over the pond in America this week. There's been a couple of big stories there. The first one, an absolute tragedy, which was the school shooting in Nashville. So another school shooting in America, this one at a private Christian school. And a shooter who identified as transgender killed six people, three children, three adults. The school placed on lockdown. And another senseless tragedy, John, in the States.
Absolutely. And actually yesterday I was speaking to a friend who has children at the school in Nashville.
Gosh.
So three kids who were there. So his kids were there in school, and he was just sharing all of what happened and hearing there was a shooting and not knowing whether your children had survived or not.
Mercifully, goodness,
his children,
wow,
had survived. He was talking about kind of the way the school had been prepared for it, and the doors were locked, and actually that meant that the shooter never got into the classrooms, which meant that the death was reduced. So schools in America are making real efforts to try to sort of minimize the impact of this. Obviously the kind of tragedy of the loss of three children, plus also teachers and the head teacher, mm-hmm, who kind of gave her life trying to sort of confront the shooter. And yeah, it just seemed senseless. Hearts go out to those, mm, who've kind of lost their children, lost their loved ones. And it's just another reminder that we live in a fallen world in which people are kind of wicked and twisted and will do kind of evil things. And these school shootings have become part of a culture in the, mm, in the US that disturbed people, wicked people, sort of are prepared to use violence in this is totally senseless sort of way. One of the children who was killed was the child of the pastor, mm, of the church that, mm, runs the school. And he spoke very movingly and powerfully about gospel hope and resurrection hope for his daughter. And I think, mm, in that context of a Christian school, they have been remarkable in both their care for others, one another, care for the school community, and also in kind of speaking the gospel more widely in that gospel kind of hope. And at one level, as we approach Easter, that's what Easter's all about, isn't it? Mm. The Lord Jesus rose from the dead, and that even for a kind of a nine-year-old girl who has faith in Christ, there is hope for kind of resurrection there. We were being reminded of that in our staff prayer meeting yesterday when we were looking at, mm, kind of 1 Corinthians 15, the great hope we have because Christ has risen. So that gospel hope was declared into that situation. I guess in these contexts, people's minds leap to what could be done to prevent this, and it raises all the sorts of questions of American gun law again. I don't know the answers to that at all. There are all sorts of cultural factors. I mean, this week in the UK, we've seen that a man, mm, has just been found guilty of killing a nine-year-old girl in Liverpool in, mm, a gang-related crime. So it's not that it's the case that the UK is somehow different. We have knife crime. We have kind of gun crime like that.
We don't have gun crime quite like this, though, do we? We do have gun crime, mm, but it's not like this. And you talked about schools sort of putting themselves on lockdown and that kind of thing. It seems extraordinary to me that even needs to be a thing that they do. Why are people not talking about the fact that anybody can buy a gun in the United States? You can't do that in Britain.
You can't, but it's a very different cultural background. So in the US, the kind of the culture of the right to own a gun goes back a very long way constitutionally. Actually, in parts of the states which are more rural, where people live, actually the police can't come to you. Actually, it's understandable why people want to be able to have access to arms. I mean, all sorts of questions can be raised of what are the checks done on people, what kind of weapons can people buy. So, for example, in the UK, as a result of Dunblane, so the owning of handguns was banned. It does seem extraordinary that in some parts of the states you can buy effectively assault rifles, mm, automatic weapons relatively easily. There is a strong campaign in lots of parts of the states to want to restrict the availability of guns and make sure that there are sort of greater checks on people. But even if you do that, in the end, it falls down to wicked people who behave in that way. And I think we do have a parallel problem with knife crime,
yeah,
in the UK amongst children, that actually guns are one way that you can kill people. We have a bigger problem, I think, or a big problem with knife crime. And regularly in the papers, you're reading stories of people who have been stabbed and killed. There was a tragic case in Northamptonshire just a kind of a week ago of a guy who was killed outside a pub in Northampton. The person who was killed is a friend of a friend of my kids at school. And so, you know, that's been brought very home, mm, to them, mm, that is a reality happening on the streets of Britain.
Can I just push on that a little bit about the gun control in the States? Because I accept what you've said, but it does strike me that there is a bit of a hypocrisy going on here where people are not speaking out about gun control, perhaps in the way they do about abortion and pro-life issues in the States. Am I overthinking that?
A little, can I say? Because I think we need to be asking what the root issues are. Are the root issues access to guns? Or are they
heart issues?
Are they heart issues? Just not wanting to be glib about what's happened. But if you look at gun ownership across Europe, there are countries in Europe that have very high gun ownership. Switzerland has extraordinary gun ownership levels, but you don't see killings in the same way. So I think sometimes you can make a difference by passing laws that prevent access to certain weapons. And as you may or may not know, assault rifles were banned for a while in America. Mm. It's the ban lapsed. It had a time limit on it, and it came to an end, and it hasn't been renewed because of the politics. But I wonder if we need to go a bit more deeply into things than that. Mm. And actually, it is something about culture. It is something about the heart. And actually, these are very difficult things to talk about. It's easy to say, well, if we ban this and ban that, then everything will be changed. But actually, I think it's more complex than that, Phil.
And I think that's true of lots of things. Whenever something happens, whenever there's a tragedy, even in our country, the natural reaction is something must be done.
Yeah, we must pass a law.
Something must be changed, as if that will solve it. And I think we do need to recognise that cultures are different. Every culture is making judgments between freedom and risk that goes with that freedom. Mm. And how they balance that. You cannot create a world in which there is no risk, in which there is no evil, in which there is no harm. And quite how a culture makes the judgment as to how to make that balance, I think does vary from place to place. And it's all too easy from a very different perspective to look in on another culture and say this is what they ought to do, without fully understanding all of the factors that are at play there. Mm.
I've got another observation, just thinking about it from a slightly different angle, Phil, is I've not thought a lot about the news this week. I have to confess, I've been very, very busy. But I feel slightly immunised against these things that happen so regularly. Mm. And I've tried to reflect on this a little bit, thinking about my own heart. I'm not as shocked as I think I ought to be. Mm. So it is a very numbing story. And when you read the detail, it's moving, it's numbing, it's shocking. But actually, when you see the headline pop up on the BBC app or whatever it is, you hear the headline, there's another school shooting. There's a part of me which is just saying, another school shooting. And I think it does tell us something about the pervasiveness of sin and how repetitive sin and being immersed in a sinful world can kind of desensitize us to sin. Mm. And I think that's a problem for us as Christians, not thinking so much specifically about school shootings in general, but actually thinking about our own hearts, thinking about our own leadership in church, thinking about the besetting sins that we actually indulge in ourselves and give in to ourselves. I think there is a sense in which the repetitiveness of sin and the fact that it just keeps coming around and you see, here's another stabbing. I think we do become... Yeah, immunised to it. I just think it doesn't have quite the same shock value it ought to have. So we do need to train ourselves and think clearly about the world, think clearly about our own hearts, and make sure that we are still appalled by sin. Mm. And I think that's true personally. I need to be appalled by sin in my own life. If I start to get used to sin, it's a really dangerous place to be. Mm. And it's the same in church life. We need to be shocked by sin. Someone once told me pastorally, he's never surprised by sin, but always shocked by it. And I think that's kind of helpful. You know, you could deconstruct that perhaps, but it's a helpful way of thinking about it, that we're realists. We're not surprised that sin is in the world. We're not surprised at the evil that is done, but we are shocked by it. And we've got to make sure we don't lose that. Otherwise, I think we're a very dangerous place.
I think we do that with passages of scripture as well. So I think we gloss over the very real tragedies the Lord Jesus deals with through the Gospels. So I think I preached the widow at Nain in Luke 7 over the weekend. That is a tragedy that Jesus confronts when he arrives at Nain. is a widow. She's lost her husband. She's lost all social security. She's lost. She's no son now. There's nobody to look after her. And that is a great tragedy. And I think sometimes we just forget how tragic the consequences of sin are.
But I think it is difficult for us to bear it because we live in a culture in which tragedy is beamed into our homes day after day after day. So I think whereas in the past you wouldn't have had news from all around the world, you wouldn't have had pictures. Actually, we are bombarded with tragedy around us. And I think, how do we bear that kind of tragedy? And at one level, I'm not sure as human beings we are meant to bear all the tragedies of the world. We can't emotionally feel about all of those all of the time. So that is right. But we are in a situation in which actually I think we hear those things. And we partly kind of despair and can't emotionally engage in them because actually we do want something to be done. We do want it to be better. We know that we can't do something. And there's all of the frustration of that. Mm. I think probably we've lost a little bit of the biblical need to lament, that actually the Bible does give us resources to deal with tragedy and bring that to God and in a sense share with God our grief at what has happened. There is a right and proper place for lamenting over those things. So actually we don't have to carry the emotional burden ourselves. Lament is a way in which we pass over that emotional burden kind of to God, who is the one who's going to bring about and accomplish his purposes. And I think we've lost something of the art of doing that because we fall into it must be fixed is our initial reaction rather than lamenting and bringing it to God.
That's interesting what you're saying there, John, about what we bear. So we had a little chat in the corridor this morning. And I said to you, what are the good news stories this week? Because I couldn't think of any and you couldn't either. Because actually, you know, the media is set up, isn't it, to report bad news. The bad news is what catches attention. Bad news is what, just draws us in, if you like, a headline. Bad news headlines are the ones that draw us in. So actually, we do need to make sure we feed our souls well, don't we? That we think about what our eyes are seeing. And that's just a helpful balance to think about, actually. We're exposed to things around the world that over most of world history, people would never have had access to. And so actually, you know, it's kind of one step removed. And
I think that's completely right. That, it's really important to be able to maintain that kind of perspective and have that perspective that most of the news media outlets have an agenda. And actually, they want to create bad news stories because those bad news stories support their narrative of we're the people who can sort the problems out. So they want to create a sense of crisis and catastrophe in order to get people to be motivated behind their political agenda. So people don't report good news stories. And they certainly don't report good news stories where the good news is because of something that their rivals have done.
Yeah.
And I think we can fall into that in church life as well. We can tell ourselves the negative stories and fail to be encouraged by the way that God is at work. And we need to basically have the encouragement of that as well. So I think in the UK, we can easily talk ourselves into thinking that we're massively persecuted as Christians just because we're more marginalised in society. And again, there's a way in which that narrative can be created to try to galvanise action. And we don't hear the kind of the stories of church growth, of progress, of blessing and increase. So I think having...
And don't always seek them out either.
No.
I think I was doing a day for church leaders in Derby on Wednesday, speaking about raising up new leaders, and we were just reflecting on godliness and characteristics of godliness, and how that transforms leadership. And I wonder actually if for many of us we are better at mourning with those who mourn than rejoicing with those who rejoice.
Definitely. Yeah.
In other words, we kind of know how to help and get alongside someone who's struggling. And actually, we see our role as pastors as fixers, and therefore we're searching out people who are mourning and want to mourn with them and help them. And you know, that's part of pastoral ministry, but it's also to rejoice with those who rejoice and to tell those good news stories, to find joy in one another and what the Lord is doing in one another's lives. And I just think that's an undeveloped strand of pastoral ministry.
I think from a Christian perspective, we need to recognise that tragedy is inevitable in our lives, that in the end, we will all become ill or elderly, or we will die, we'll experience loss and grief in our families. That's part and parcel of living in a fallen world that's under God's judgment. And I think in that sense, that's the great failing of a prosperity gospel model that seems to think that if you're following God, everything will be blessed and good and you'll escape tragedy. The Bible doesn't promise that. It says that that is the reality. You will have trouble in this world. These things will happen because of sort of sin, because of a fallen, cursed world, because of evil, wicked people. Our hope is that God in the end will put everything right and renew everything.
And this is another pod, but I don't think we know how to grieve either. So I think we mistake, you know, we have this sort of sense of national mourning And we don't really have any other category than the sort of public display of so I just don't think we know how to grieve generally for loss. And actually, that's not just loss of in terms of death. That's loss in terms of you know, health and a job, perhaps, or identity, our identity in the world. We just don't know how to. I mean, it's connected to what you're saying about lamenting. We don't know how to deal with loss, I don't think. So we'll come back to that one, perhaps, Phil.
Maybe. Well, let's just stay in the States. Moving on. Extraordinary story developing overnight about the former president, Donald Trump. Seems he's going to be indicted over allegations that he paid hush money to a glamour model who he was said to have had a liaison with. He's going to be the first ex-US president to face a criminal charge. Extraordinarily, I was reading this morning, it won't necessarily derail his push for the presidency at the next election in the US, and some actually saying this will galvanize his base. It goes back to what you were just saying about how the stories are presented, John. So actually this might actually strengthen him, because it will feed the narrative of the world is against Donald Trump. I mean, it's a circus, isn't it?
Said Phil Topham, well, I mean, executive director of
it looks like
I mean, I don't understand American politics. I read quite a lot of politics. I enjoy politics, but I really do struggle to understand American politics. And I talk to friends that are over there, and I think we don't realise quite how politicised life is.
And church.
So, you know, the fact that people are publicly registered as Democrats and Republicans often, for example, that the fact that, you know, even positions of the district attorney and so on are essentially political appointments, and, you know, are, again, polarised and politicised. And all the way through the judicial system, and not just the judicial system, you know, you're voting in the chief of police often in cities and things like that. I just think we are, I mean, you could argue that under the surface, there is an element of our judicial system being politicised. You know, people are appointed and those sorts of things. But it's not like it is in the States. And I think, talking to friends who live there, unless you live there, you really don't quite understand how politicised everything is now become. And I think this is, you know, it's difficult to judge exactly what's going on. We haven't seen the indictment. We haven't seen the evidence. It's been before a grand jury, so it's been in secret. So a lot of it is, you know, kind of tabloid stories.
Speculation, isn't it, at the moment?
So we don't quite know what to make of it. But it is just a reminder that the United States of stateside is extraordinarily politicized.
I mean, you're right that he's the first person to have been charged in that way. That's not because there haven't been American presidents who could have been charged. Mm. So, of course, there's a comparison here with Richard Nixon and the Watergate scandal, who was forced to resign, could easily have been charged for a whole variety of federal offences. In fact, a number of members of his government, like Charles Colson, who subsequently became a Christian and ran Christian Fellowship, were in fact found guilty and were sent to prison as a result of that. But Nixon was pardoned by President Ford, who came into office afterwards.
And others doing illegal things. So yeah. I've been watching Ken Burns' documentary, 10-part documentary. I think it's on Netflix or one of those other
streaming service.
Other streaming services are available. History of the Vietnam War. And a lot of stuff in the 60s I just wasn't aware of. I hadn't realised that all the conversations in the White House were taped in the 1960s. So there's extraordinary recordings of Lyndon Johnson doing essentially illegal things in terms of committing troops, sending people in, and then publicly working out what they would say, so they sounded as though they weren't breaking the law. So it's just the duplicity is extraordinary. So actually, there is you know, whether people have been charged or it's out in the public, a bit like Nixon, or whether it's been more hidden, and perhaps a bit like Lyndon Johnson and the whole Vietnam build up. I think those things are deep.
And it's right and proper that leaders, even the most powerful leaders, are not above the law, that they're held to account. So here the claim is a bribe of $130,000 was paid. Actually, the lawyer who arranged that for Donald Trump says there's far more to come out in terms of things that are being made there. But it's right and proper that people are held accountable by the law. To some extent, we see that in our own country with our own politicians. Mm. I remember the politicians who were sent to prison for their expenses kind of scandals. You're not above what the law requires. Mm. And I think that's a reminder to us all that in the end, we will all face God's judgment. We will have to answer.
Mm. Yeah, nobody's above the law. What lessons can we draw for Christian leaders about how we see politicians behaving and the public persona?
Goodness. Where do you want to start? Well, I think...
draw big principles. We've got
Integrity.
Yeah, yeah.
Integrity.
Yeah.
So I think there is a lot of do what I say, not what I do, in leadership generally. Mm. And I think we've got to be very clear that as Christian leaders, we are called to act with integrity. We're not just teachers. We are to set an example. That's very clear in 1 Timothy 4. Mm. Timothy is to set an example in speech and love and faith and conduct and purity. And also, he's actually to make progress in that, public progress. People are to see his progress. So I think that leadership in the New Testament is lived in the community and lived out in the community. It is a teaching ministry. It's a ministry of the word. Mm. But it is... enhanced, that's probably not the right word, augmented, authenticated by the way a leader lives and behaves. And that's why, as we've talked about a lot over the years, and it's increasingly becoming clear, we must be talking about godliness and gifting. Mm. These are both key components of leadership. And the integrity of those being connected together, I think, is absolutely essential.
I think politically, the Bible, leaders are sinners and flawed. The Bible doesn't give us a great expectation that we're going to have brilliant kind of non-Christian leaders with integrity. I mean, in some ways, in our country, we've been influenced by a Christian background that has shaped the culture of leadership, and we're still living off the heritage of that. Mm. But actually, I think we want honesty and integrity, but the Bible tells us that very often leaders are self-serving in the way that they do that, and we sort of have to recognise that. I wonder if here there's a particular lesson in the church. I think it is this kind of a body of people who support Donald Trump no matter what, no matter what's revealed, no matter what he's done. And we mustn't fall into that in relation to church leadership, where church leaders are seen to have been flawed and have failed. And those leaders might represent a position that we hold, a constituency that we are part of. And there's a danger, in a sense, of kind of defending and not recognising the reality of what's happening. So I think there is a lesson there for kind of how we view church leaders when wrongdoing is exposed, and actually that there's a tendency to kind of leap to support, to defend because of what they symbolise, and we mustn't do that. We need to respond appropriately. So, I mean, for example, just this week it was in the news, a pastor from Hillsong in New York who left his ministry because of kind of marital infidelity has now been appointed pastor of another mega church. I think it's in Oklahoma. You kind of think, I just don't understand that at all. How can somebody who has been in ministry in that way be appointed and welcomed in that sense? That seems to me to be an inappropriate response to the exposure of wrongdoing that ought to disqualify.
Let's bring it back home. We're going to go to Scotland for a few minutes. We're going to talk about the SNP leadership. So announcement this week, Hamza Youssef beat Kate Forbes to become the SNP. I was going to say 52-48. Yeah. That's a number we recognise, but let's not get into that. So 52% for Hamza Youssef. So he became the new SNP leader. Kate Forbes... A campaign of honesty and integrity, and we're very grateful to God for her. And I just wanted to touch on, not necessarily that, but what happened after that. So on his first night in Bute House, Hamza Youssef posts a picture on social media of him leading his family in prayer. Imagine if Kate Forbes had won and posted a picture of her.
It's worth saying, by the way, he's the first Muslim.
Well, it is. And I'm not taking anything away from that, but what if the shoe had been on the other foot and Kate Forbes had posted a picture of her family praying in Bute House? How do you think that would have gone down on social media? Is there a double standard here, or am I reading too much into it? Am I being controversial where there's no controversy?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I don't know Kate Forbes, and I think it highly unlikely she would have posted a picture of that.
Because it's a private thing, really.
It is, and I think a point was being made. I think... there is a sort of an underlying feeling that Christians are got at more than Muslims. Probably, Christians might say, because we don't fight back. So actually, you're not going to be attacked. If you attack a Christian, we sort of seem to turn the other cheek. And I think there probably is some truth in that. It does seem, in very general terms, that Christians are easier game than people from certain other faith communities. But I think we can probably overstate that as well. And I think that what's going on in Scotland is very interesting because it's highly secular. And yet the two people who came first and second in the SNP race, both people of faith faith. And not only that, but actually, faith that kind of does affect how you think about things in public. So it seems to me there's... there's more to this story than just a picture of people praying, and that wouldn't have happened if it had been you know, or it would have happened differently if it was Kate Forbes. I think there's probably a bit more going on. And it may be actually that people are more tolerant in the general population rather than sort of the elite who are at the tops of political parties, that people are actually more tolerant of religion than we think.
I mean, it's worth saying, when Tony Blair was in office and was known as a Christian and had a sort of a religious advisor, there was some suspicion about that and the influence of religion on...
Yes, but he had, a Bible and
a
Quran.
He carried a Bible. I read that.
Covered all the bases, didn't he?
I mean, I think the key thing here is that people know what Kate Forbes' beliefs are. It's not just the fact that she's a Christian. It's the fact that she's a Christian who believes that sort of gay marriage is wrong, who believes that children should be born within a kind of marriage. So she really believes Christianity. And I think the question here is that actually people are happy in the public sphere with a religion that really doesn't believe what the religions believe. So they're quite happy with a sort of a wishy-washy Anglicanism that really doesn't hold any convictions. Nobody gets particularly upset that the king talks about a vague Christian faith in his kind of Christmas message, because it doesn't really have any political implications, because it fits with the broader kind of public agenda.
You call it folk Christianity, don't you?
Absolutely.
Yeah, yeah.
I think Hamza Yousef, I mean, he has made very clear that he supports the progressive agenda in Scotland. He's made very clear that he's going to continue to promote gender recognition. He's going to continue to promote conversion therapy. So he is no threat to the secular view. And actually the question is raised, is that really what Islam teaches? And does the wider Muslim community recognise that as being a reflection of their values and their teaching? So on the whole gay marriage issue, we know that Hamza Yousef didn't vote basically because he was taking the advice of his kind of mosque. He clearly didn't want to alienate them.
Well, allegedly, yes.
It was absolutely one narrative.
He had a meeting elsewhere. So I think
I've got to go.
It's a question of what religion. It's not just religion. It's what does that religion believe? What are its convictions? So there are some Christians that would be more acceptable than others. Basically, those who, in a sense, have abandoned what we might see as being the core kind of convictions and beliefs that the Bible teaches that are unacceptable in our secular culture.
We will see how he gets on in office as the leader of the SNP and indeed Scotland's First Minister. And finally, before we go, it's Word Alive coming up in a few days. So we all love the local church, Adrian. We all love being part of the local church. What part then do conferences like this play in the life of the believer?
You know, because we believe in the local church doesn't mean that we don't believe in doing things collaboratively together. And there are actually things that we can do better together because perhaps they cover the whole country, or, you know, so you sort of think about if you've got a group working on some particular issue, that actually in the local church, we don't have the time, the energy, the expertise to think about clearly. We can use groups like CARE or Christian Institute or Christian Concern, for example, to help us think through an issue and lobby and things like that. So I think just because we believe in the local church doesn't mean that we are inherently suspicious and negative about everything that happens outside of the local church. And FIC is a good example of that. You can collaborate together without jeopardising the primacy, I suppose, of the local church. And I think one of the great things about these events like Word Alive, you could talk about Keswick in the summer. There are other sort of family conferences that people go on. UFM, for example, missionary organisation, have a family conference. Is that actually that they can often provide access to things that you just can't get access to in the local church because you're just a bit too small. So I'm really looking forward. We're off to Word Alive this week and I'm doing a little bit of teaching, but I'm really looking forward to going to a couple of seminars on autism and some other things. I think actually these are quite specialist subjects I want to know more about, and I wouldn't be able to access that teaching elsewhere. Word Alive is pretty expensive. Keswick is much cheaper. I mean, there are sort of different levels you can access these things. And it's also worth remembering that most Christians in this country are in smaller churches, including in the FIC. So actually, that's kind of exacerbated. If you're in a church of 400 or 500, you're thinking, we do have a seminar on this, or we do have an expert on that. But most people are in churches, perhaps where they haven't even got a regular preacher. And just going and being fed, especially, and John, you can perhaps talk about this a little bit more, having really good children's work for your children to plug into. They might feel alone and isolated in your church, one of just a handful perhaps. But to go somewhere where they're mixing with other children their age who are all believers, I just think these things can have enormous importance. They're serving the local church, they're not replacing it.
I think that's right. And I think, you know, there is much encouragement of gathering together with a larger group of Christians. Mm. And you sort of see that dynamic through the Bible. Actually, in the Old Testament, you meet locally in your synagogue, but you come together in bigger gatherings occasionally. And there's a great encouragement of being part of that bigger kind of people of God. You inevitably meet a wider range of people, different people. In that sense, it's a little bit more of an approximation or a slightly bigger foretaste of what it might be when we're all going to be gathered together as God's people. So for most of us who are in churches of 100, 120, to gather together and sing with 2,000 people is just hugely kind of encouraging and fostering those relationships. I think for our kids, it's been hugely significant. If they're, you know, in a small church with a small youth group with maybe no kids at kind of school who are also Christians, actually you can feel very isolated and very different. Suddenly you're with a large group of people where actually you're Christians together, and that's been tremendously helpful to our children in terms of sustaining them and keeping them going.
It was spring harvest when I was growing up, and thoroughly
and still is.
Enjoyed it. Yeah, absolutely. I used to go when I was a kid to spring harvest. Yeah. Brothers,
I've got some news.
Oh, go on.
Today we are launching the Independence Club, Phil.
Right.
Which is great news. For $29.99 a month, you can have early access to episodes. Mm. You can have exclusive episodes.
Extra content from John Stevens.
Yeah. And live content as well. You can interact live with us as we record.
Brilliant.
I think that's really good value. You know, as we reach a larger audience, it's really important that we kind of sustain the work. So yeah, £29.99 a month, pounds.
Yeah.
Really good value. You can sign up online, I'm pretty sure, somewhere.
Yeah, and we're launching that on April the 1st.
We are, yes. Go for it. Very good.
Excellent, brothers. Thank you very much. Good to chat with
free,
you today.
Always yeah. Free. Enjoy, the free yeah. Church, always free. Yeah.
Enjoy Word Alive, and we'll talk to you again after Easter. Happy
Thanks,
Easter.
Phil.
Thanks, Phil.